lunch and learn. So what I wanted to speak about today was a temple that is a little bit overdue. The plan was to give this year originally last week or 2 weeks ago. I can't remember exactly, but the point is it is overdue, so it's a little bit odd. Usually we're done talking about the Beis HaMikdash by the time 3 weeks are over, but it's always good to talk about the Beis HaMikdash, so we'll speak about it a little bit more this afternoon. And so the topic is remembering and rebuilding the temple. What are we waiting for? And the truth is it probably is more apropos to talk about this the day after, or 2 days after Tisha B'Av, than during the 3 weeks. During 3 weeks, we're mourning the loss.
Definitely
now we
after the Nefesh
B'Nefesh. Yeah. So now is the time to be talking, why aren't and why haven't we built the Beis HaMikdash yet? Right? So why is it a fair question?
I mean, why?
Okay, good. Right. Meaning, so I'm coming from the perspective of saying that it was one thing, 100 years ago, there was no land of Israel. Obviously, it was always there, but we were not the primary owners and inhabitants of it. Nowadays, though, it's a really important question, because you would think that if we're not the primary owners or the primary inhabitants, then we have, even though maybe we should have gone in there earlier or whatever, we couldn't do it. We were kicked out. We were not allowed in for 2,000 years. Now that we're back, you think that we should have an obligation, right? You think that we should really be, this should be number one on the list. So number one, set up a government. Number two, make sure you have a police force. Number three, I guess make sure people have homes and places to live. Number four, everyone, build a Beis HaMikdash. This is it. This is everything that Judaism has been fighting for. This is everything. If you would have found anyone in the concentration camps during the Holocaust, anyone in the ghettos during and before that, everyone would have told you, our dream is to go to Israel and build a Beis HaMikdash. So the question really is, why have we not done it yet?
So we haven't gone, all of us, number one. And two, maybe we have not earned it. And we question the reasons why we haven't. But I just have to interject this very good story that I read on Tisha B'Av in the Jewish press. So this guy says he had a dream the night before, on the 9th of Av, and he saw that the temple was coming down and all the ropes were hanging, and they didn't know. Everybody is standing, waiting, and looking. So all they had to do was pull the ropes, and it would have gently come down. But in the background, they have everybody. The ultra-Orthodox say, how can we do this? First, we have to see Hashem or Mashiach, whatever. The Reformed are standing around saying, what do we want that for? We don't want to have animal sacrifices again, the bonus. The conservatives are saying, well, if we stand here and wait, we want assurance that changes will be made to meet the 21st century. And this goes on and on and on, and before you know it, you see the thing going up. And that could be a major problem.
Just a little bit of a political...
Okay, good. So we'll see that there's a lot of truth in both of those ideas, right? The one idea is that we just really, as far as we have come, we still have not been able to fully get our act together. Number two, even though there is the ideal and imperative to build a Beis HaMikdash, to have a Beis HaMikdash, we still have to understand that we live in a very politically sensitive world, and the fact that could imagine if someone would have gone and this is being recorded, so I'll be careful how I say this, but I'm speaking hypothetically and not telling anyone to do this, so I guess it's okay. But one second. So let's say someone would go and blow up the Dome of the Rock, which again, not telling you to do that, not the best idea. But if one were to do that and then go build a Beis HaMikdash, you could imagine you could start World War III. So that's going to be one of the main reasons why we don't do it. Howie.
The right wing answer is because we established a democracy instead of a theocracy. How can you build a Beis HaMikdash when there's driving on Shabbos and all these democratic ideals? That's not what Israel should be.
Okay, good. So another perspective that we'll consider is this idea that if there was a Beis HaMikdash, as amazing as it is and as ideal as it is, God's presence would come down to live in this world once again. The amount of serious prohibitions that would be reintroduced to Jewish society, which no longer are around, for example, like having a Sanhedrin, like having an official court that could be able to offer out judgments like stoning a person who's Mechalal Shabbos in public, or the laws of Tumah and Tahara, the idea. idea that a woman who is a regular woman who's in her menstrual cycle, you know, that entire period of her life, the fact that if she sits on a metal chair during her cycle and she has not gone to the mikveh, then that chair is now impure. And if someone else sits on that chair, that there are tremendous implications to what would happen if the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. So as much as we do say we want it and desire it, there is so much more depth there. So we do have to, we'll consider that as well. Yeah.
So, just the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash by default have to include animal sacrifices. The rabbis found a way to substitute prayer for animal sacrifices. I'll animal sacrifices, but I could see. You know,
I'll answer you only like this because this officially is the third part of a three-part series. The second part did deal with animal sacrifice. So the answer is most likely we will have animal sacrifices once again. But going back to Gerald's point when she said that the reform are the ones who didn't want the animal sacrifices, I'm sure there are a lot of Orthodox people who also don't really want animal sacrifice.
My thought really is, and I thought a lot about it over Tisha B'Av, as you talked about a number of times, can we really relate to this? Can we really believe this? I have a heart, as much as I want it, as I see it as the final days, when the promise, the final days, when this will come, I find it hard sometimes to imagine, even those ropes, as we're told that's what's going to happen.
There are a lot of true believers out there who still, everyone has that doubting part of them to say, is that really going to happen? And if it happens, what is it really going to be like? Is that really, really what I do want? Of course, it is what I do want, but really, do I want that?
Is that really what Hashem is going
right.
to want in the end?
Right,
like,
right.
Are we really
going
to want
right.
to go back to that? When we...
And in those days, they didn't have chairs, right? So we'd have to have a chair committee.
the board that's going to oversee the Beis HaMikdash is going to be.
I think it's so telling. I mean, I was joking that we could hear, my 2-year-old granddaughter's shiur on the Beis HaMikdash, which my daughter-in-law videotaped for me. But I think that to Gerald's point, it is true that if you look at children who are the most innocent, they really have the most faith because they don't have the noise that we have in the rest of our lives.
Right.
And, the modern world, modernization and technology has caused us to be so distracted that it's forced us to become cynical rather than have the...
I was just reading, I think it was on Facebook, someone had posted the day after Tisha B'Av, that their, 4-year-old daughter woke up and she said, "Mommy, was the Beis HaMikdash built yet?" And the fact that a 4-year-old will ask that question, everyone who is a little bit older knows, of course, that's not true, because we know the Beis HaMikdash wasn't rebuilt. We spend, I'm reminded of the story of, there's a big drought, and everyone goes to the Kotel to daven for rain, and then everyone's going there in their shorts and their flip-flops, whatever, and then one guy brings an umbrella, but there's a drought. Why is he bringing an umbrella? So his friend says, "What are you doing? It's not going to rain. Why are you bringing an umbrella?" He says, "Aren't we all davening that there should be rain? So if I really believe there's going to be rain, then I should bring the umbrella," right? So
I wouldn't, because if I bring an umbrella...
but that sort of emunah pshuta, that simple faith, is something that is totally lost on most adults, whereas kids...
We're almost shooting ourselves in the foot because we teach it to our children so simplistically and they get jaded very quickly because, what are they taught? We need to be nice to each other. You need to keep the mitzvot. Okay, so that starts at 2 and at 3 and at 4 and by 6... They're saying, "Okay, mommy, I'm being nice and I'm keeping the mitzvot, and there's no Beis HaMikdash."
Yeah, 100%.
Okay,
100%. Okay, there's a lot more that we could have a whole schmooze on this for like 2 hours, but there were some things that I did want to specifically discuss. So number one is the question of, how do we remember the Beis HaMikdash nowadays, and how does it either A, prepare us for the coming of the new Beis HaMikdash, or B, just at least keep it in our hearts? That's part one. And then part two will be the more practical sense of why have we not built the Beis HaMikdash nowadays. So if I were to ask you, how do we remember the Beis HaMikdash nowadays, I would divide it into two categories. There are two ways that we remember the Beis HaMikdash. There are a number of things that we do, but two ways that we remember. If I were to ask you to categorize them, how would you categorize these two different ways?
Huge edifice that magnificent.
No, but in other words, what do we do in our lives that allows us to remember it?
Well, we've got it every day.
Well, is mostly, I think most of us are into bringing a sacrifice of some kind.
So it's interesting that you should say that, because I wouldn't necessarily categorize the tfilos and the karbonos that we say as a way to remember the Beis HaMikdash, although you inevitably do. And the reason why is because we're doing that because it's an obligation, right? We do it to this day. We read karbonos and we daven because those are obligations that we do. Not as a remembrance for the temple. We do them because we're obligated to do that every single day. There are things that we do specifically just to remember the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, good. So one is the category of things that I guess you would call like symbolic remembrances, right? So things like breaking a glass. What else would be another example of breaking the glass?
You're not supposed to paint the whole. You're supposed to leave a part
of the house.
Good, right? To leave like one amma by one amma square unfinished, unpainted. If you're like redoing your house, good. Use of putting the ashes.
Yeah.
Put a good putting the ashes on the chassan's head at under the chuppah. What else?
Those are all symbolic. I mean, I think also it nothing to do with prayer, but the Kohanim, right. Yom Kippur, that becomes a big part of it's davening, but it's not something we daven every day.
Okay, good. So
it's a particular, like.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. In other words, you're saying that there's a part of just, it's just our own memory, right? We just remember it through our prayer. Okay, so I would even put that in a separate category. Okay, good. So we have just basic remembrance. We have two symbolic things that we do, like breaking a glass, like putting the ashes on the chassan's head. What are some other? What will be the other category of things that we do to remember the temple?
Visit.
Okay, when a woman has a baby, doesn't she come to where they used to bring doves to, you know, an offering to the temple?
Okay.
After they had a certain period of time, or
and you did that. And, right?
Yes. that women seem to want to do that still in a different way. Again, that's prayer.
Okay.
It's not, I don't know if it's symbolic, but.
Okay, good.
It's a way of us.
What would be another example of something that we do that specifically we're told we do this as a remembrance for the temple, but it's not symbolic, it's more.
A memorial.
That might be a good word to use. Okay, so I'll tell you what I'm thinking. So there are things like rabbinic enactments that they're not symbols, they're practical extensions of what we used to do in the Beis HaMikdash, almost to sort of tell us that we can live on without the Beis HaMikdash. So for example, what is the Torah obligation to bring the Lulav and Esrog? How many days are we obligated to bring the Lulav and Esrog?
One
day. Why do we bring it the rest of the days? The rabbis told us. Why? Good. To remember the fact that this is what used to happen in Yerushalayim back in the day. So we do things like that. There are mitzvos like that we do in order to help us remember. Why do Kohanim? Why do they not wear shoes when they duchen?
Because they didn't in the temple.
Good. They didn't in the temple. Before the temple, it seems like anywhere else, they used to have no problem wearing shoes. But after the temple, there we'll see in a little bit, but Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he said, we're going to make it that you do not wear shoes to help show that there is a part of the temple that will always live on with us, even after the fact that the temple is no longer standing. Okay, so let's take a look at source number one. So source number one is the famous Gemara of Basra. I think we probably, in some context here, we've already seen this Gemara, but we'll read through it briefly. And so this Gemara outlines what happens after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and everyone was in such such a distraught state. So it says, a rabbi's toe on the temple was destroyed for the second time. Large numbers in Israel became ascetics, committing themselves neither to eat meat nor to drink wine. And Rabbi Yeshua got into a conversation with them and said to them, my sons, why do you not eat meat nor drink wine? They replied, shall we eat flesh which used to be brought as an offering on the altar? Now that this altar is not being used, shall we drink wine which used to be poured as a libation on the altar but now no longer? So what do you think? Makes sense or no? Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, right? And that's probably why maybe we don't. One of the reasons why as we get closer to Tisha B'Av, right, the 9 days we don't eat meat or drink wine. So one basic and the most obvious understanding is that those things bring happiness. Maybe another understanding is that we are kind of picking up on some of these chumras, these strategies that people of yesteryear wanted to take on. But here's why they didn't take them on. Let's keep going. Like number two over there. He said to them, if that is so, we should not eat bread either because the meal offerings have ceased. They said, that is so and we can manage with fruit. So now they're not eating meat, they're not drinking wine, and they're not eating bread. Those, especially in the olden days, those were huge, major meal components. So, but they're only going to eat fruit. We should not eat, so now they're told back, we should not eat fruit either, he said, because there is no longer an offering of first fruits. Then we can manage with other fruits, they said. So now they're not eating bread, they're not eating wine, they're not having meat, and they're not having a lot of different fruits. They could have other fruits, but he said, we should not drink water, because there is no longer any ceremony of the pouring of the water. And to this, they could find no answer. Right? So you see, at the beginning, it sounds pretty reasonable, but if you follow along that logic a little bit longer, the stringencies would have been way through the roof, and no, there's no way that a human being could survive anymore. And so on the one hand, you understand hopefully a little bit from where these people were coming from, especially coming on the coattails of Tisha B'Av, the pain that they could have, that they were feeling, that their temple was no longer there. Again, after 600 years kemat of having been there for them, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, their great-great-great-great-great-grandparents all knew of the Beis HaMikdash. This was the first generation in 600 years that didn't have one, and so they felt horrible. But there is a limit to how much you could mourn, because of course we are still supposed to live on. So what happens? So paragraph number 3. So he said to them, my sons, come and listen to me. Not to mourn at all is impossible, because the blow has fallen. To mourn too much is also impossible, because we do not impose in the community a hardship which the majority cannot endure. As it is written, you are cursed with a curse, yet you rob me of the tithe, even this whole nation. The sages therefore have ordained thus, a man may build his house, but he should leave a little bare, right? That's one of the stringencies we spelled out already. A man can prepare a full course banquet, but he should leave out an item or two. So this is an interesting thing. You don't really see this so much, and I'm not so sure why, but there's this idea, either maybe you could leave an extra dish out, so you were going to have a 10-course meal, maybe you leave one of the courses out. The way the Shulchan Aruch codifies this idea, and I believe, is that he says that you can set the whole table and leave a part of the, leave like one of the seats open or something to sort of show that we lost something. Let's keep reading. A woman can put on all her ornaments, but leave off one or two. For so it says, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Okay, blah, blah, blah. You can read to the end. Okay. And there are a few more ideas quoted, the idea of putting the ashes on the head of the chassan, and the like. Now, why do you think it would be that some of these things are kept to this day, and some of these things are not kept? For example, someone told me, I think recently, that only up until recently did they start putting the ashes on the groom's head, but back in the day they never did that. Is that right?
I have never seen it yet.
Yes, okay.
So, yeah. I'm sure you have seen it. Maybe you haven't even thought of
it. Yeah. A black coat, yeah. And the ashes.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. Why is it that we keep some of these things and we don't keep other of these things? Or even over, as time has changed, do we not do this? Do we either do more or do less? Why?
Well, in some ways less, and then all of a sudden it turns around and we do more.
That's true. So what's this about?
And once it becomes more, it's like everybody has to do more.
In other words, the Gemara just said that a woman should leave one or two pieces of jewelry off. I'm not going to pinpoint any of the women in this room, but right. So what does that even mean? Right. At some point.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I always learned that on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur,
yeah.
I always take all my jewelry off.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Right. That's very appropriate. Yeah.
Right.
But why Tisha? The Gemara doesn't specify Tisha B'Av.
People who say, well, if it's something that you wear every single day,
you can keep it on. Right.
Okay, so
it's like a kala also.
Okay. These might be for slightly different reasons.
Because she's supposed to be pure and just though nothing else.
Yeah, but okay, you're getting at interesting points. Yeah.
The closer you come to the realization of a possible place of Mikdash Shlishi, the more religious you become, and the more you keep observing these things.
In other words, the more you miss the temple, the closer you get, because you can feel it more palpably. It's very deep. Okay, good.
I think also that, I don't know if it's political, it's both political and religious. If you have groups now that are so polarized, you have the very right wing, and that's where you see the ashes. You don't get the charedim.
No, the ashes, everyone does the ashes now.
My entire
friend group, everyone, including myself, all did ashes.
Okay,
nowadays, I believe, I don't...
But will you go to a many
ones,
you don't see...
Do your kids have ashes at their wedding? Of course they had at their wedding.
No, I did not.
Really, why?
Because Arif Baal Teshuva, I guess, his rabbi.
But that's what
I'm
like a rabbi.
It depends on the rabbi.
Fascinating. Okay.
Very few that you
I don't remember.
I could count.
Or something.
I think it's become a lot more common.
No.
So I think it has become a lot more common. And I'm going to incriminate my generation.
Okay. Now we're getting some.
More common, but I think that a lot of the parents in my generation will say to their kids, I didn't do this, and you don't have to do it.
Right.
Stuart and I were not of that philosophy,
right.
So we were,
right.
You know, we were okay if our kids did it.
But I don't think it was that, I never saw it
until my boys came home from
New
York.
Benji, definitely, for sure. I'll text him after. We'll get to the bottom of it.
Rabbi, you can text him, but it's possible.
Who's Masar Kedushin for him?
What do you mean, by
Rabbi Kalamar, no?
How do you get the ashes from what?
You just burn ashes. It's not
the same as the ashes that you put on your...
For Ash Wednesday.
What about Petition?
Yeah. Same.
Lauren's
a little frumber then.
I'll give you another.
That's very interesting.
Let's move forward here.
I don't think Benji did it.
I was at all of their chasanas.
Would
you
have seen him walking down
the aisle?
No. It's under the chuppah they do it, and then usually it's like it comes off. It's not a bit. You can't really see it.
Because
Benji
sure didn't have
it. The most important thing for a Jewish wedding, the pictures have to look nice. If the pictures were ruined, forget about it. This would be outlawed before anything else.
Right before they break the glass.
Yeah, exactly. When they sing the Mishkach, usually they do it around then.
But I'll give you another example. When Jillian's 32.
Yeah.
When she went to seminary. When she got to seminary, they would not tear in Kriya.
Really?
Right. No.
Really?
No.
And then Zachary comes to us.
That my nephew done came.
Yeah. And then Zachary came to us and he says, "I need an extra T-shirt to tear
Kriya." When he goes see Rishalayim.
That Stuart.
He was very upset. He was upset.
And so is Stuart. That Stuart was upset about that.
Well, yeah, because all these kids are ripping their nice shirts.
Because you don't.
Associated with death.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's why, Stuart had already sat Shiva for his father, he said to him,
My
daughter did
that's
it.
So
but
funny.
He did it anyway.
Yeah, whenever, God willing, go back soon. Hopefully, next time we're all back, we won't have to tear Kriya. But yeah.
You may get him on the tuxedo. Now what happens?
You on your white shirt.
Oh, forget about it. That'll be outlawed. All you need is one. That'll be outlawed.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
It's like white wine. You have to keep
a lot of my husband's friends who their kids are very from.
Okay, everyone. After this class, what we're gonna do is everyone's gonna go home and ask their children and their grandchildren and their nephews and whatever, and they're gonna find out if they did it. And then after, we'll take a poll and understand.
I would say that they did. I'm
99%
sure.
Okay, but that's a David thing. I don't talk about David.
Whatever.
Okay, so let's move on. So what does this Gemara pull out for us? Which things is this Gemara saying? Are they the symbolic things or the more rabbinic enactments to help us move on? The Gemara that we just saw in Bava Basra.
Remind us what it says.
The Gemara Bava Basra that says to put ashes on the groom's head. I don't want to start the conversation again.
Good.
So the Gemara only has symbolic things. In the Shulchan Aruch, we're not going to see it inside because this conversation has gone on for way too long already. But the Shulchan Aruch lists most of these things. It gives a few more things. one thing that other people won't do. This is actually something that, again, I don't know what they did in yesteryear, but for sure now I have seen people be more machbid on. And that is that the idea of a chasun or kala wearing like a crown type thing on their head, particularly like a kala for sure, like a really really fancy nice tiara, is not really necessarily seen as such a good thing to do. The Shulchan Aruch says that they shouldn't wear crowns. Why don't you wear a crown? Because you're mourning the Beis Hamikdash. God willing, when the Beis Hamikdash will be rebuilt, the chasun and kala could dress however they want. Yeah, but again, so this might be a thing that also has changed over time. So have you? Only going to ask one question, then we're going to move on. Did you guys see it more back then? That people
like a crown, not a crown, like a really fancy tiara.
No, well, that's because people are a little bit more lenient how to define what a crown is.
Right.
But like, I don't know.
Like a whole round.
Maybe something like that.
I don't think so. But a tiara.
Whatever. Okay.
Yeah, the veil have something.
Yeah, let's keep moving. Okay, fine. So the second category of things is, like we said, the rabbinic enactment. So take a look at source number 3 for a second. It's the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. Take a look what the Gemara has to say. So you'll notice that the Hebrew is a little bit shorter than the English. That's because the English is a little bit more in-depth. But let's see, read it. Source number 3.
Over here.
You got it? Yeah. Okay. The sages don't look at my thing. My thing won't help you. Okay, the sages taught in a braisa, priests are not allowed to ascend to Duchen with their sandals to the platform to recite the priestly blessing in the synagogue. And this is one of the 9 ordinances that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai instituted. 6 are mentioned in this chapter, sounding the shofar on Shabbos and Yavneh, taking the lulav all 7 days, the prohibition against eating new grain the entire day of waving, accepting testimony to determine the start of the month all day, etc., etc. Right, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, we're going to do this outside only because we just need to move a little bit quicker. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai instituted 9 laws that were sort of, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai lived, those of you who were, went to my Pirkei Avos year?
A long time ago.
Good, very good. A long time ago is the right answer. Approximate numbers, approximate time periods.
During the Roman...
Good.
During the time of the second...
13-1.
Mid 1300s.
Very early 1300s. Like 13.
13, I meant.
Yeah, so he lived like right around the time after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. Right, so like a 1300 years before that. That's what you meant. 1300 minus 1300, I guess.
Minus.
Okay. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was living in this time right after the temple, and he understood very clearly that he needed to find a way to help people move on after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. You saw just a second ago the conversation that Rabbi Yehoshua had with that whole group of people who didn't want to eat anything anymore. They didn't want to drink what? They didn't want to do anything. So that's a very, very dejected crowd that... How are you going to move forward if you're going to allow Judaism to continue? How do you allow Judaism to continue? What do you do to move forward? So you have to, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he says what you have to do is you have to set up Judaism in a new way that people are able to fulfill their Judaism that makes them still remain connected to the temple. So he added all these extra things, quote unquote added, things like taking the lulav for all 7 days, things like Kohanim not wearing anything on their feet ever when they duchen. The reason why is because we want to take the temple with us even to the outside world of the Beis Hamikdash. The Beis Hamikdash is no longer here, but in our hearts it still really is here because I'm bringing the lulav every day just like they did in the temple. I am not wearing shoes when I duchen just like they did in the temple. So all of these things are the second category, the more rabbinic enactments to help bring the temple into the world without a temple anymore. Good? Okay. So fine. So now we dealt with the question how we remember it. We said that there are symbols and there are rabbinic enactments to help bring the temple with us. What are we waiting for? Why haven't we rebuilt it yet? Before we get to the technical political element that we live in the world nowadays, okay, good. So, what do you mean by Mashiach?
He hasn't come.
So what?
No, but,
who says we need to wait for Mashiach?
But who says Mashiach? I mean, isn't it so that okay? We think about the Beis Hamikdash just coming down, which we can believe or not believe, but also that. It's going to be a slow, we're not going to notice it like, boom, one day Mashiach's going to be here.
Okay, good. So what Gerald is referring to is the machlokas between the Rambam and Rashi. Right? So how will the Beis HaMikdash come? Is it going to come? Is it really just going to fall out of the sky? Or is it going to be rebuilt? Is it going to be a process? Are we going to lay the bricks slowly? So,
and they say that Mashiach is already here. We just may not know.
Okay, could be. All right. Okay, so let's take a look at source number 5. It's the Rambam and his Mishnah. They built them by men. So you're a Rambam man. Yeah, a lot of what I would call more Dati Lumi people living in Israel who are religious Zionists. They're, and myself also, I'm probably more right. In my personal opinion, right? The people who let's lay it out like this: the people who believe that the Beis Hamikdash is going to come through a miracle because it's going to fall out of the sky are more people who are sort of in the camp thinking that how do you put it, that the world is in such a poor state nowadays that the only way this thing could actually happen is with a miracle. The people who believe that it's going to be rebuilt, and this is, I'm you know, oversimplifying obviously, but the people who think that it's going to be rebuilt brick by brick are more people who believe, no, we're very far from it, but we've also come so far and we can keep pushing and we can actually get there. Arthur's point to say that the first two were built by man, so why should the third one not be? That's a very strong point. So let's take a look at the Rambam. The Rambam agrees with you. But so he says as follows in his Mishnah Torah in Hilchos Malachim, source number 5. Now, if a king should arise from the house of David who is versed in Torah and engages in commandments, as did David his forefather, in accordance with both the written and the oral Torahs, and he enjoins all of Israel to follow in its ways and encourages them to repair its breaches, and he fights the wars of God, right? We saw this source on Sunday as well in the Mashiach Shir, then he may be presumed to be the Messiah. If he succeeds in his efforts and defeats the enemies around him, builds the sanctuary in its proper place, and gathers the dispersed. Everyone know where we are?
Not
source number 5?
It says 4 on the bottom.
It says 4 at the bottom, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I apologize. It's 5. I apologize.
4 at the bottom.
It's halacha dalet, so it's like it's the 4th. I apologize. Okay, so we're at the bottom two lines of this source. If he succeeds in his efforts and defeats the enemies around and builds the sanctuary in its proper place and gathers the dispersed of Israel, he is definitely the Messiah. So what does the Rambam say? Those of you who were in the Mashiach Shir on Sunday, how will you know if someone is Mashiach? How will you know? Among other things, he's going to build the Beis HaMikdash. So the fact that Mashiach is building the Beis HaMikdash means what? It's not falling from the sky. He's going to have a construction team come, a very nice construction team, I'm sure, but they're going to come build the Beis HaMikdash. This source that I brought here does seem to allude to what? What will we need to have the Beis HaMikdash? We will actually need Mashiach to be here. How would you get around that? What can I tell you to argue with that?
Besides having Mashiach, some other way.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we won't know for sure.
Good, right? Maybe there'll be a guy that comes around and says, guys, this guy is a very nice man. He's been doing a lot of good things for the Jewish people. And he comes around and says, guys, we have to build the Beis HaMikdash. Maybe we'll realize that he's Mashiach after he's finished building it. That's what the Rambam seems to say. He's going to build the Beis HaMikdash, and then we'll know for sure he's Mashiach. So Mashiach does not really have to, quote unquote, come, just like Gerald said. He is alive right now, perhaps. And he'll just sort of reveal himself at that point. Again, maybe it could be someone at this table who's Mashiach. It's not so crazy.
Somebody comes along, build a man, build somebody, I will accept him as a Mashiach.
Yeah? Okay, you heard it here first.
Just like I was in the Baal Shev Ebba, I would have bought a couple of them.
Okay. We said on Sunday we only speak about the Rebbe and this Mashiach stuff off the recordings. Okay, source number 6 is the famous Rashi, who says the Mashiach, that the Beis HaMikdash is going to fall from the sky. He says a person is not without going into the technical details of what the discussion of the Gemara is, the Gemara presents over here this idea that a person is not allowed to build a Beis HaMikdash at night or on Yom Tov. But, says Rashi, for the future Beit HaMikdash, this rule doesn't apply because Hashem is building it, as it says in Shemos, the sanctuary of the Lord, which your hands established. So essentially, Rashi is explaining over here that man is not building it, Hashem is building it, then poopy is going to open up the door, and it's going to fall to the ground, and everything's going to be nice. Okay, so that's Rashi's opinion. Okay. Assuming, let's say for a second, so again, if you hold like Rashi, what's the answer to the question why we haven't built the Beit HaMikdash yet? We can't do it! It's going to happen when it's going to happen. According to the, so put that whole theological perspective on this side. Let's go back to this theological perspective. If you're a Rambam person, like Arthur is, and you're saying that we're going to build the Beis HaMikdash, so why haven't we built it yet? How will we know when we are ready to build it?
We find that the man comes up and says that
he's fired. Time has to be correct.
What do you mean?
Access to the... For example, we have a war and suddenly knocks down the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Is gone. We have an opportunity now to do what we want, right? So there has to be.
So let me ask you this question. When? Well, okay, yeah. Keep finish your finish.
I'm saying it has to be. So many things have to fall in line in order to be able to do it.
Okay, good. So let's fast forward now to modern times. Take a look at source number 7. So yeah, and there's a little one there. You see what I'm saying? 7 is on the right. Yeah, with me. Okay. So the Rambam says again, continuing. No, you're not with me.
No.
Okay. Well, what's happening here? Yeah, right here. Okay.
Yeah,
it's
on page 4.
It's the second. It's the second.
Page 4. Yeah.
Right. Underneath the Rashi, we, okay. Right, we'll figure it out. Okay, good. So the Rambam says in his Mishnah Torah, continuing along the same idea that we just read before, says the king, the Mashiach, will stand up and return the kingdom of the house of David to its old glory. So the first rule, and build the temple, and gather the scattered ones of Israel, and return all the laws in his days as they were before, bringing sacrifices and making lots of other exciting things. So, based on this Rambam, why have we not rebuilt the Beis HaMikdash?
Because somebody stood up and said, this is it.
What do you mean nobody stood up? The Rambam doesn't say that Mashiach has to stand up and say, I'm Mashiach. He just says that he's going to do these things. So, why haven't we done it yet? Why haven't we built the Beis HaMikdash?
We showed up.
Okay, good. Let's take a step back for a second. I would have believed what you just said if it was 80 years ago, 90 years ago, 100 years ago. Why is today different, or is today different?
We have Israel.
What else do we have? What's the other qualification? Good, we have an army. What's the other qualification the Rambam says? Gather the scattered ones of Israel. Is that not happening right now? Are we not living in the times where people are literally coming from all the four corners of the world, coming back to Israel?
True.
So it sounds like we are. To visit and to move. People from all over, right? This is something every year. There's a new random group that's found somewhere and they come to Israel.
Is it possible that we're in the formation of doing this? We just haven't arrived at the correct time.
Okay, good. So one perspective will be, and essentially we will probably end up concluding with that idea, that is that we're getting there, right? So people, we spoke about in the Mashiach Shir on Sunday, that every single generation, it seems like, there has been some rabbi to come up and say that Mashiach is going to come soon, right? And they've all been wrong.
Well,
So people that do get up and say that we are in this time of redemption right now, what makes those people any different than the people 1,000 years ago who said Mashiach is going to come in the year 1200? What makes us different is the fact that we have begun to see some of the real symbols. The fact that we do have the land of Israel back in the hands of Jewish people. The fact that we do have an army. The fact that we do have people who are there's a growing religious population there. The fact that there is an ingathering of exiles. There's all these things. So that does beg the question of what is next, and why is building the Beis HaMikdash not like number one on the list right now of things to do? We've done all the things that necessary. So why is number one now not to build the Beis HaMikdash? With me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So what's the answer?
I don't know if this is an answer, but I don't know if there is just one answer, but what I'm thinking of is that maybe we are afraid.
Mm-hmm. There has to be a catalyst.
We're scared.
Mm-hmm. We have no catalyst.
Okay, good. I love that word catalyst. Take a look at source number 8. We're not going to read it inside, but it is... Source number 8 is the transcript of what happened during the Six-Day War, at the end of the Six-Day War, when they broke onto Har HaBayis, right? And they recaptured the Temple Mount, right? The famous words of Har HaBayis Bielinu, the Temple Mount is now in our hands, on June 7th, 1967. Why was that not the catalyst? They were literally on the Temple Mount. Okay,
but
so what happened?
They were told not to take it. Moshe Dayan told them to stop.
Right. Politics is
probably a cheap way of saying it, because it's not, just say politics, that just sounds wrong. It's a really complicated world that we live in, and to say that, as even just looking now in retrospect, the way that the world continues to view Israel as this occupying country, as this country who is constantly trying to grab more land for itself, the fact that it is still so small, and the fact that we legally acquired so much land during the Six-Day War, and we had to give so much of it back, you can imagine what sort of upheaval there would have been if some person would have come to blow up the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
That would have been an old story by now. It would have been okay.
Right.
Okay, good. So there is that perspective out there that says if they would have just done it, so fine, we would have had to give back the whole Sinai Desert. Okay, fine, but we still have the Beis HaMikdash.
It would be yesterday's news. Right. We would be in a different place.
Yeah, there is that whole perspective.
It's too late to think that, but I think what we need is that the Catholic should be an overt act of God.
Okay, so you're saying now, so how do you define an overt act of God?
Something that's irrefutable. For example, my dream, and I have a dream, the dream is this. One day we wake up, every nuclear facility in the world is dismantled. It's melted. Except Israel's. You understand?
That's a good dream.
That's a dream that shows you, hey, How could this happen? They didn't do it. Israelis didn't do it. Nobody, the great power didn't do it.
If Israel's the only one left with the nuclear weapons, I'm pretty sure everyone's going to blame Israel. Even if Israel didn't have the missile.
You are the chief. You are the chief country in the world at that particular point. Yeah. You can do whatever you want. Go up there and pick that muscle.
But at that point, you wouldn't be... At that point, that too much would have had to have happened. I mean, forget the nuclear weapons. I have to say that here's the thing. When you're reading that, and what Colonel Gore said, and I remember that day watching television, seeing it, and I still get chills when I hear those words. And I think that what it is that we do not believe in miracles any longer.
Well, you know, it's an interesting point that you're bringing up.
The state of Israel is a miracle that we exist.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think here in America, we often don't subscribe things to being miracles and being the hand of God as often as they do in Israel. When you are living in Israel and you are seeing on a daily basis the fact that there are Israeli soldiers standing in the same place that Avraham Avinu walked, and you have people who are constantly protecting people, putting aside all the horrible murders and deaths even until, you know, just a few days ago that have happened, the fact that you have Jewish people that are standing there and that are fighting for our right to live in this land, the fact that we do have that, I think most people living in Israel see the hand of God. I think in the 67 war, I think even American Jews saw the hand of God but saw that as a miracle. But yeah, people, like Stacey said, people move on and things are yesterday's news. As amazing as this was, you know, a few decades ago, now, okay, we have the Temple Mount, and then we have to give it up, and now it's international. Now the fact, you know, as Rabbi Eben was speaking about at our joint keynote service on Sunday, when you visit, again, this is a complicated halachic area, I do not recommend necessarily going on the Temple Mount, but if you decide, based upon the advice of a competent rabbi that tells you you can go on the Temple Mount, which we'll see in a second what the official policy of the Israeli rabbinate is, but if you person does decide to go on the Temple Mount and they see the fact that a Jew goes in the Temple Mount, it's like a big deal. Why? Because there are Arabs all over trying to attack you. If you show your yarmulke, if you're muttering words under your breath, that is clearly, you know, a world where we do not own the Temple Mount. But again, rewinding back for a second and thinking of what would have happened if they would have taken a few steps in a different direction, if they could have actually come to really acquire the Temple Mount and keep the Temple Mount in our hands, it would be totally a different world.
But if we truly believe in the hand of Hashem and his omnipresent in the world, why can't we believe that he will be the one to decide?
Well, I think that the answer
is...
That
we have to do our parts.
Right, so I think that's the tension, though. Where is that line
right
between how much we have to do? Right, so maybe God is sitting up there in heaven right now and saying, come on, guys, take a rocket launcher, take down the mosque. Right, how do we know that? I'm not saying that he is, but how do we know that he's not? Right, so that's everyone agrees that God, I hope, that God will ultimately step in and do this for us, but and everyone agrees that we have to have our own hishtadlus, we have to try, but the question is, where is that line? Whose court is the ball in right now?
There's a Jewish statement that my mother used to say to the boy, D.T. Boyle, God will help you. You do it, and God will help you.
You have another situation. Let's assume you have an earthquake. Knock down the, whatever that building's called, right?
Yeah.
That could be, quote, a miracle, from Hashem.
Yeah.
Now it's time.
Yeah, could be.
You know, everyone would say, it's not a miracle. Earthquakes happen, and, you know. But on the other hand, some other people can say, this is it. This is the sign to...
Well, if it's a criticism...
There's a beautiful song. Are people familiar with the song, Anavim? Anavim, Anavim, Higiyaz. No, okay, no one knows. Okay, there's a song. I don't remember where it's actually from. I don't even remember who sings it, but I know the song. And the song goes that Mashiach is standing on top of the roof of the Beis HaMikdash, and he's screaming out to the world, humble ones, the time has come for Mashiach to be here. The time for your redemption has come. And the question that everyone likes to ask on the song is, why in the world is Mashiach standing on top of the rooftop of the Beis HaMikdash, telling everyone that the time of redemption has come yet? Don't they realize the time of redemption has come? Why do they need someone to tell them that? And the answer is because even as much as we continue to, God willing, move forward in the world of redemption, and as much miracles as we do see on a daily basis, people, there will always be that group of deniers that will need literally Mashiach to stand in front of them and tell them, your redemption has come before you're actually going to believe it? Right. So, yeah, that's just, it's just the way of the world. There are always going to be the doubters and the naysayers out there. I want to move forward because I do want to finish up soon. So source number 9, we're not going to see it inside, but it's an amazing article talking about the fact that there are people who do want to start moving ahead with the building of the Beis HaMikdash on the Temple Mount. Again, feel free to take a look at it. It is an article from the New York Times, so it's an interesting one. Sources number 10 and 11 will help us confront this question of why we haven't done it now. And so if I were to ask you to summarize and to synopsize, give me two different words that will be two different reasons of why we haven't built the Beis HaMikdash now. So one, we said it a million times already. One is the politics. But the other is?
The will to do it.
Okay, the will. I think if you...
Will to do it, meaning that
I think we do have the will to do it. I really do. Right?
That's
okay, good. You're getting there.
We have to agree on what we're building.
Okay, come on. Stop. It's not... not to, what? That's politics.
But,
so what's the other reason? Halacha. It's unclear if we are halachically allowed to build it. The reason why is because it's a little bit unclear if we exactly know where everything is supposed to be. Right? One of the complicated issues of going up onto the Temple Mount nowadays is that how do I know exactly where everything was? And if I don't know, one second, if I don't know exactly where everything was, then maybe I'm not able to stand there. So what's the obvious workaround to that point?
No, we're not duplicating the way it's supposed to be.
Okay.
No, but you don't go because you don't know where you're permitted to go.
Okay. Okay, good. So, but I'm assuming we're living in the real world now. Mashiach has not come yet, but we still believe we're supposed to build the Beis HaMikdash. Or maybe this guy has said he's Mashiach, but we don't know it yet. So, how would you work around it?
Gemara tells you exactly what's going on.
So the Rambam... Where? No. The Gemara does not tell. The Gemara does not have diagrams. Does not. We have a pretty good sense, but it's a very complicated issue.
It's
very complicated.
No, but right, but what are the directions that
you're... We know approximately where everything is, where everything should be, right? This direction, that direction, we know all that stuff, but in other words, there are parts of the Beis HaMikdash. No human being can go into the Kodesh HaKodeshim other than the Kohen Gadol. Well, in theory, also the people who repair it, but that's not a question for right now. If I go into the Kodesh HaKodeshim accidentally,
you're in trouble.
And yeah, and we believe it, you're in trouble. Now,
why
would it's not necessarily, probably not such good things. I will tell you that it's not so simple. It seems that in the times of war, things are a little bit right. There's a famous picture of Rav Goren, right, standing like in the middle there with the rock there, right? People familiar with this picture, so that may be where actually the Kodesh HaKodeshim was. So not such a simple question, but the point is, if you're just going up to visit the Beis HaMikdash and you're just going to walk into a room like that, we believe that's not such a good situation. So if you don't know exactly where, you know, down to the inch where something is, then it's not so good.
Well,
okay, so there's the halach. Yeah,
if they
specifically avoid certain areas because they just don't know.
Yeah.
For more than just the halakhic reasons, right. But yeah. Okay, so we have a little bit more. I think we have a little more time. So I just want to conclude by looking at source number 11. I don't want to read the whole thing because it's very long, and this is just like an excerpt of like a 25-page essay. But this sort of really gives the position of the Israeli chief rabbinate, and it explains why we are not going up to the temple, why we are not rebuilding the temple nowadays. Okay, so take a look at source number 11. The outcome of the 1967 war and the reunification of Jerusalem caught Israel's chief rabbis by pleasant surprise, as it did the country's Jewish population and Jews worldwide. The chief rabbinate had to deal with a potentially new reality. For the first time since the destruction of the second Jewish temple, the area of the Temple Mount was under Jewish sovereignty. It's an unbelievable thing. As an institution recognized by successive governments as the spiritual head of Orthodox Jewry, the chief rabbinate has sought generally to adopt halachically acceptable positions which did not conflict either with official thinking or the broad non-Orthodox majority in Israeli society. That's a very hard line to toe. The capture of the Temple Mount presented two possible scenarios. The reintroduction of temple worship, bringing the biggest revolution in Jewish religious life for 1900 years, or to seek to incorporate the capture of the Temple Mount by the Israeli army within existing patterns of Jewish religious behavior. This article will examine the factors which led to the chief rabbinate choosing the second option and the position on the issue in the period since, right? Obviously, the chief rabbinate chose not to rebuild the third Beis HaMikdash. So let's take a look at the next paragraph, the third temple. Three schools of halachic thought on the Temple Mount question that may be traced within the Israeli chief rabbinate. A first school favors building the third temple today. The only chief rabbi who backed this position was Rabbi Shlomo Goren, right? He was very famously there, and this before the 1967 war, and for a short period immediately following, at the period when Goren had not yet been appointed chief rabbi. At the 1962 Oral Law Conference, Goren said that if the old city of Jerusalem would ever be captured from Jordan, there would be a need to rebuild the temple, right? So he's not saying that it's like a nice thing to do. He's saying you're chayav, you're halachically obligated to build it. After the Temple Mount fell to the Israeli army on the second day of the 1967 war, Goren, then army chief rabbi, asked Central Region Commander General Uzi Narkis to place 100 kilograms of dynamite in the Dome of the Rock. Wow. Goren repeated the need to blow up the Dome of the Rock at an all-day seminar on the Temple Mount for reservists and the military rabbinate. In the heat of war where there was much bombing, such an action could have been carried out, Goren claimed, without even a formal military order to counter sniper firing from the Jordanians on the Mount. After the war, Goren asked the armies in engineering corps to measure out the precise location where the temple had been situated on the plateau. The title of a paper he intended to present at the Oral Law Conference in August 1967, which was devoted to the subject of the temple, was Building the Temple Today. So it was a real reality. We were very close. Goren's view that the temple should be built today was based on a ruling of Maimonides, which drew on the verse, and you shall build me a sanctuary, right? The idea of the Asuli Mikdash. You have to build it. The Torah says build it. So when we are given the opportunity, you should do that. Maimonides set certain prior conditions. There was a need first for a return to the Jewish monarchy, the reinstitution of the Sanhedrin, and the end of Amalek. Some saw in the new state of Israel a return to Jewish monarchy, the existence of a functioning legal system as fighting off Amalek, and the chief rabbinate as the embryo of the Sanhedrin. That was the first school of thought. You have to rebuild it now. A second school held that the third temple will be built not by man, but by the Messiah, and there was nothing to do but pray and wait. Good. And then skip a few paragraphs. Go to the next paragraph that says, according to a third school of thought. According to a third school of thought, Jews should be allowed to enter parts of the Temple Mount where the temple was not situated. This school also accepts that the temple will be built by the Messiah and not by man. Proponents of this school include Chief Rabbi Eliyahu, and after altering his view in late 1967, Goren. Right, so Rabbi Goren changed his view. Since the temple buildings occupied only 15% of the original Temple Mount area, the size of which has since doubled owing to construction carried out by different occupying forces over the centuries, it is permitted to pray in those areas of the mounds where the temple building was not situated. While the precise location of the building is a matter of dispute, there is a consensus regarding the areas where the building was not situated, notably in the northern and southern expanses of the mount. According to this school, it is permitted to pray in these areas. Okay, you can keep reading on your own. Finally, so look at the last paragraph, access to the Temple Mount. From the outset, Unterman and Nissim imposed a ban on Jewish access to the entire Temple Mount. Within hours of the mount falling to the Israeli army on the second day of the war, Israel radio broadcast a warning issued by the chief rabbinate not to enter the area of the mount and banning access to the Temple Mount. The chief rabbis were following Maimonides' view that the Shechina is still present at the spot of the temple, right? So it's a little bit of, again, another halachic complicated question. If God's presence is still there, how that works, and how that plays into where I can or cannot walk. Entry to it is forbidden and punishable with kares, given that the Jews are in a ritual state of uncleanness today in the absence of a red heifer, right? The golden, the paraduma, the ashes of which are required for the purifying process, right? So this is still continues to be the position of the rabbinate to this date, that one should officially not really go on there because it is halakhically not appropriate because we are tameh. Other people, again, I don't know if it's a majority or a minority. I think it probably still is a minority of people who do go up. They'll tell you, what are you talking about? We do have avenues to purify ourselves. We don't have a red heifer, but I can go to the mikvah. So people will go to the mikvah and they say it's totally okay. Again, not such a simple question, but that's where the rabbinate falls nowadays. And these are all the possible reasons why we would not rebuild the base of English. One is that we should do it, right? Two is that we can't because Mashiach is going to rebuild it. Three is that ultimately the political situation and or the fact that, yeah, just the world that we live in just would not be able to tolerate it and allow it. Therefore, we cannot build it nowadays. With all that said, so where does that leave us? What should our perspective be in terms of rebuilding the temple?
Do everything else we can that could lead to the building of it.
Good. Just as Arthur and a few others said throughout this year, that at the end of the day, even though we cannot actually physically go up there and build it, there are still metaphorical bricks that we can continue to lay to build the base of Middash. So the hope and the prayer is that this past Tisha B'Av that we had just a couple of days ago should be the last one in mourning. And God willing, next year in 5, 7, 8 year, we will have a base of Middash with a rebuilt base of Middash that either we will all build together or the Mashiach will bring down from heaven himself.